Welcome to the Fabulous 413. I'm Monty Belmonte. Khalise Smith is immersing herself in art outside of the 413 area code and hopefully enjoying a much-needed respite, although don't be surprised if Memorex Khalise Smith shows up every once in a while over the next few days. Later in the show, an organization helping to bolster local journalism at local newsrooms, including ours here at NEPM. We'll talk with former Report for America journalist, the Republican's Greta Yoakam, and current Report for America journalist, NEPM's own Nirvani Williams. Plus word nerd Emily Brewster, resident wordster from Merriam-Webster, our dictionary in Springfield, on a category of words she's investigating that were poetry before they were prose. And speaking of poetry and prose,
the Montague Shakespeare Festival. Is the Capulet Shakespeare Festival going to be upset?
Well, we always like a bit of friction, really. Makes good drama.
It sure does. All the world is a stage, but specifically Montague right now. Until April 7th, the Montague Shakespeare Festival. What's your name?
Kenny Butler.
And what do you do with the Shakespeare Festival?
Well, I founded it, and I'm the executive director.
I'm Fee Ross, and I've come over from England, from the Royal Shakespeare Company, to direct the production of Dream at the Shay that you're going to see later.
Is Dream what you call Midsummer Night's Dream in the world of Shakespeare?
I think we try and shorten all the titles because they're mouthfuls sometimes.
Except for the Scottish play, which you have to make it more verbose, especially in a theatre.
I think we're following some of these rules, aren't we?
Do you mean about the Scottish play?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Lots of spitting and crossing and turning around three times every time I mention it.
I'm going to make a full disclosure. This Shay Theatre is owned by the town of Montague. It is run by a volunteer board, of which I am the president. I am an unpaid volunteer, but I love being an arbiter of culture and community on both this radio show and in the community where I live of Turner's Falls. So I was very excited because my children have been part of a Shakespeare program here for the last 10 years, the Young Shakespeare Players, where kids as young as 7 years old are doing full uncut works of Shakespeare. So Shakespeare has been a very important part of my family's life. It's what got me involved as a volunteer with the Shay Theatre here. Kenny, tell us what made you want to found this first ever Montague Shakespeare Festival.
I'm not a Shakespearean expert, but I am a radical for Shakespeare.
Tell us why.
I love his text, and I love what happens on the stage. I love when people speak his text and play it, when they have caught the rhythm of it.
Mm.
So that attracted me to first come up with an idea for a workshop here in Montague, and to bring over experts in voice and text and in Shakespeare from England. Because I followed some, Nia Lynn at first, who actually is the artistic director, and she's the one, luckily, who found Fiona for us, and Fiona was kind enough to come and direct everything.
So, and they're both from Royal Shakespeare.
Yes. So at first I was told Nia Lynn, I said, hey, let's do a workshop here, a weekend workshop. And she said, why do a weekend when you can do 2 full weeks and 3 weeks, including workshops? And so I said, oh, okay, let's try that.
And the festival will culminate with the production of A Midsummer Night's Dream that you, Fiona, will be directing. I can sort of see by some of the stage setup that's up here on the stage of the Shay that it might not be a traditional period version of A Midsummer Night's Dream. Not that a fantasy outdoor forest setting has a specific period necessarily, but
I think if Shakespeare was putting these plays on now, he'd be reinventing it all the time. And I think the more barriers we can remove in terms of what we put in front of an audience, ways of connecting, so that we go, oh, this world isn't so far away from me. All these people I understand, because these stories are timeless. They've lasted 500 years. And it's not just the stories, it's, as Kenny says, something about the language, which is so muscular and so exciting when you get those words in your mouth. And actually, you mentioned young people, and I've worked with a range of actors and children as young as sort of 5 and 6. And the ability to inhabit those huge emotions that Shakespeare presents. And I think these plays send us away with more questions than we arrive. And that's, I think, what theatre should do. It should be a provocation to go, well, what do you think about these things that go on? How do we feel about the world? And that's why they're a treasure, and that's why they last.
Tell us about the rhythm of Shakespeare, the iambic pentameter that is so famous, and why that continues to resonate, as you said, 500 years on.
Well, it's very compelling. I think we talk in iambic pentameter anyway. Would anybody like a cup of tea? Ba-dum, 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 ba-dum. Mm-hmm. It's the rhythm of a heartbeat. It's the rhythm of a galloping horse.
Yeah, it's a cumbia for people that love music too, which is, yes. I mean, I want to see the mashup of Shakespeare and cumbia someday.
Yeah. And Cis Berry, who's died sadly, who was such an important part of the Royal Shakespeare Company. She'd talk about it being like jazz. You have the undercurrent of the ba-bum, 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 but then you have your actors. You can do anything over the top without losing that drive, and that's what's so delicious. He gives you lots of options, because remember, Shakespeare was an actor as well as a writer. Mm. You know, he understood how things felt on stage.
Speaking with Fiona Ross from Royal Shakespeare Company, who will be leading workshops and directing a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream here at the Shea Theatre, the Montague, first ever Montague Shakespeare Festival, goes from now through April 7th. I'm also with Kenny Butler, the executive director. Royal Shakespeare Company may be something that people have heard of before. We have Shakespeare and Company just west of here in the Berkshires. Tell us a little bit about the history and the importance of the Royal Shakespeare Company.
It was set up in the 50s initially to do Shakespeare, to sort of reinvent, and we do a lot of, or the company has done a lot of community work as well, and I think that's a really important part of its heritage, is that we involve the community, and that's what Kenny's doing here. He's opening up and going, all right, come on, this belongs to you. You can do this. Come and be involved, see what you can discover. So really,
And it's in Stratford-upon-Avon, right? Shakespeare's hometown?
It is, and there's always a long debate about where Shakespeare belongs, because he lived most of his life in London as a producer, as a theatre producer and an actor and a writer.
Yeah.
So there's always this ongoing battle between, not a battle exactly, but the Globe claim him, absolutely, because that was his theatre, which is a wonderful place to perform, actually, open air, and really in touch with your audience on that stage. And Stratford goes, no, he belongs here. He was born here. He is the Swan of Avon.
What makes it the Royal Shakespeare Company? And do you know where Kate Middleton is right now?
Well, there's the million-dollar question, isn't it? I'm gonna leave both of those hanging. King Charles is one of the patrons of the Royal Shakespeare Company, actually, and he pops in and out quite a lot in very beautiful shoes. I've seen his shoes a lot.
In a pit, directing, or while you're on stage?
It's the royal handshake, but you know, you kind of look at the
shoes. Oh, yeah, you can't look him in the eyes. So we bring Royal Shakespeare from Stratford-upon-Avon to kind of genocidal colonist upon Falls, Massachusetts, here in Montague on Avenue A in Turner's Falls, so-called. Kenny Butler, who's the executive director of this Montague Shakespeare Festival, first ever, it's not just this production that Fiona will be directing of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It's so much more. Tell us about some of the opportunities that people still have to get involved with and learn about Shakespeare from Fiona from Royal Shakespeare Company.
What's wonderful is we have it here. They have Avon, we have Connecticut River. And those two things are merging in a sense where you have workshops here. We have performances and we have workshops. And you can find them on the website, montagueshakespearefestival.com. We've actually done it virtually. We have a total of 6 events, and 3 of them are webinars that Nia is doing from the UK. And she actually kicked it off with sonnet sessions, a workshop. A lot of people showed up, and it was actually, we're kind of international because, Zoom, people from Canada showed up, locally, United States, Wales, and England. Mm-hmm. We have 2 more of those. We have the ensemble workshop tonight, ensemble building workshop tonight that Fee will be doing. And on Friday, and this is what we wanted to do. When I say we, I mean people who are working here in the community with me and with the festival. We have Shakespeare in the Classroom, which is a teacher's workshop for Montague teachers. I'm very excited about that because they get to go back to the classroom and bring the things that everyone here is learning. Then we have a few more. We have character development coming up. We have making Shakespeare your own, which allows you to create a personal approach to the Bard.
That's Kenny Butler, who's the executive director of the Montague Shakespeare Festival, which is happening at the Shea through April 7th, culminating in a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream. It is supported, flying buttressed even, by Royal Shakespeare Company's Fiona Ross. One of the things that has always astounded me when my children have participated in this is the voluminous amount of text that they are able to memorize. I am a middle-aged man who can barely remember your names while sitting here with you, as was evidenced by that dramatic pause. Are there tricks that you still use, Fiona, to try to commit the words of Shakespeare to memory that may not just be for Shakespeare, but maybe something that you can carry on with you as your brain starts to decompose like mine is?
Well, Shakespeare text is much easier to learn than anything else, actually, because of the rhythm. There's something, and you automatically know when you're a just casting around for words, something, it's sort of, because of the rhythmic drive of it, you sort of fall into that and it bypasses the head sometimes and gets lodged in the body. So it's like being a dancer, you get the muscle memory, if you like, for the text. I don't know how I remember. It's sometimes people record things. I just learn it, actually.
Yeah.
I just
Does it stay in there forever? Like, do you feel like you'll have it there forever, or is it, it's like a control-alt-delete once that production is over?
I think you probably remember about 1.5 speeches from each production, sort of 3 years later. It stays in your head for a wee while, and then you just bin it, because you can't keep everything. You cannot keep everything in your head. It's like being in an acting company, actually. You form these incredibly deep, deep relationships very, very quickly with the other actors, as you do with the text, and then you go, yeah, yeah, see you, keep in touch forever. Never see them again.
What does the Bard have to offer a 21st century audience, and how does his work fit in an age of curriculum censorship? More with Royal Shakespeare Company's Fiona Ross and Kenny Butler from the Montague Shakespeare Festival, and later in the show, Merriam-Webster's Emily Brewster on words that were poetry before they were prose, and we'll learn about local journalism from two Report for America journalists, Greta Yoakam and Nirvani Williams. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
Speaking with Fiona Ross from Royal Shakespeare Company, who will be leading workshops and directing a production of A Midsummer Night's Dream here at the Shea Theater. The Montague Shakespeare Festival goes from now through April 7th. I'm also with Kenny Butler, the executive director. When I was a kid, Shakespeare didn't speak to me when I would try to read it on the page. It was difficult. I do remember distinctly going on a field trip to Shakespeare and Company, and it came alive on the stage. It was meant to be experienced that way. You had a young experience with Shakespeare that made Shakespeare come alive for you.
Yeah, it's like it was yesterday, sixth grade. My teacher played, by the way, I believe it was the Marlon Brando Julius Caesar movie, right?
Oh, the one where he chokes on an orange at the end? Oh, no, that's
that
the Godfather.
The yeah, that's a different one. And the teacher explained it. She must have been a Shakespeare lover of Shakespeare, right? Because she explained, she said, hey, look at this character. He's going out to the crowd, and he's going to manipulate the crowd with words. And he's going to turn the crowd against his foes and to him. I said, oh, that's interesting. So we watched it.
I come to bury Caesar, not to praise him. The evil that men do lives after them. The good is often turned with their bones. So let it be with Caesar.
And then she said, and Shakespeare also changed you during the process. And I was just like, this is incredible. How do you do that? And he did it with words.
I don't know any politicians that try to do anything like that currently. So there are no contemporary resonances with Shakespeare in that regard.
I did everything right and they indicted me.
Fiona, what drew you to Shakespeare? I mean, people from here will hear your British accent and be like, everybody in England knows all of Shakespeare. But I'm sure that there's something more personal that made you get involved and to the level that you're part of Royal Shakespeare Company.
No, again, like Kenny, I had an extraordinary teacher. She was a nun, actually. And I think we were about 14, and I think it was Caesar. Again, we must have all been studying it. And she literally cleared the classroom, piled all the desks up, got the chairs, and we turned into this mob of plebeians. And and it was that, really. And it was, and I was actually a very shy child, so having these words as a mask, if you like, was very empowering for me. So I think that was partly it. I mean, it's like a lot of actors, they're quite retiring sometimes and shy, and it's much easier to be somebody else.
And teachers will have an opportunity to learn about Shakespeare and go on a deep dive during this Montague Shakespeare Festival. I know that there are scholarships even for teachers in the Montague school system as well, right?
All Montague teachers. I mean, if they just wanted to show up on Friday, they could. But they're coming.
Yeah.
We're very excited.
It's all about teaching Shakespeare on its feet rather than, as you were saying, sitting down and reading it. You can't. It's very difficult. It needs to be on its feet. You need to feel it. You need to walk it. You need to share it. And then you hear those words in the space. So it's all very, very practical. It's all activities that the teachers could take straight back to the classroom and do.
Well, I don't want to forget the actors who showed up to the festival. We put the word out. We gather people who are interested. And that's everything from technicians to actors and creatives. And see who would just show up and start talking about what we would be doing. No casting, no auditions. So the day before the first rehearsal, everyone showed up. They were given scripts, and we read the entire script from beginning to end. Yeah, we played.
We played for about 4 or 5 hours, just on our feet, really, and just tried to start building a company, tried to start building an ensemble, because then you get the best out of people. you know, rather than auditions, which are hellish.
Yeah, one-on-one usually, yeah. All alone, but then, yeah.
But if you're working, you see how people relate to one another and you can see how they respond in the room.
We are in an era, in this country in particular, where there's been revision in art from previous generations. There has been complaints about the nature of art and its influence on our children. There are bans on drag story times across the country. People would then, maybe many of those same people, hold up Shakespeare as the gold standard of why don't our children learn Shakespeare and some of the more ethical things like William Shakespeare, the greatest in all of the English language. When you look at the works of Shakespeare, I wonder what your take is on that response to what's been going on politically in this country with, especially, I guess, with drag shows.
Yeah. Well, I think, as I said earlier, I think theatre's a provocation and it challenges us, and I think that's why some people don't like it, actually. Mm. Certainly in the UK, it's a different. There's a sort of closing down on the arts generally. Shakespeare, as you see, has this sort of golden aura, but he's a rebel. He asks really difficult questions and makes us think, and people that think are dangerous.
Mm. So many of those themes resonate now when there's so much gender bending going on. The fact that even in its time that I think all the actors would have been male playing female characters. These are not things that were controversial at that point, but are now. What's your take on that?
Oh, I think anybody can play anything, and absolutely, I think it's a very welcome change to, as I say, it's a reflection. Art reflects the real world, and the real world reflects art, and I think we must embrace that, and we're doing a little bit of that in this show as well, which is very exciting.
Tell us what we might see in this version of A Midsummer Night's Dream that will titillate the audience. It's next weekend and the weekend after, right?
Yeah, it is March 29th, March 30th, April 5th, 6th, and 7th.
Well, our fairy band are not very traditional fairy bands. They're a bit like eco-warriors. They're a bit like party ravers. Mm. They have a sort of alternative. And the play opens at war, as Shakespeare suggests. There's a war going on. Mm. And out of that war, out of chaos, there's a sort of healing that goes on in some way. So we're playing a little bit with that idea. So the set is constructed, maybe by necessity. I think that's a really good thing of recycled stuff, things that you might find on the street, etc. So it's quite playful.
It is not lost on me that there is a shopping cart on the stage, and in many ways, the stray shopping cart is the icon of Turner's Falls.
Now, I want to be clear. I did ask permission.
I have a couple shopping carts that I use on the food bank march that you could borrow anytime.
Okay, thanks. Yeah, it's almost like you know, we came here, and not only with the company, it's like, what company will we get? Who will show up? But also, what ideas are people going to have? Fee is great with the cast because she'll have an idea, but then she starts asking them, well, what might we have here? What should we do here? I'm saying it's built out of a dystopian Athens of the past, the future, and the present. But, you know, the themes are so striking because right at the top, you have a power play from parents that are trying to control their grown children and then using the state to get their way. They don't even just tell their child, you're going to marry who I say, or you're going to go be a nun or be dead. And the state will kill you. How's that for a comedy to start off?
Again, no contemporary resonances that I can think of.
No. There was a recent production of where they used Margaret Atwood's Handmaid's Tale. I don't know if that was big over here.
Yeah.
But that sense of that very patriarchal pyramid sort of power structure. We're changing it a little bit because we have a female-identifying Theseus as well. Mm. So who struggles with that idea? And it's a journey for that character.
And it still fits with Shakespeare, which is ancient. And that's what's amazing to me about it. Fiona Ross from Royal Shakespeare Company. Are there any contemporary things that you watch where you would say, if Shakespeare were writing today, I can imagine he'd be a writer on this movie or on this television show?
Oh, yes. God, what's the one with Brian Cox and the...
Succession.
Succession!
Yeah.
How Shakespearean is that?
The safety briefing. Well, here's the safety briefing. If you move against me, I'll put a hole in the back of your f***ing head.
It absolutely would be. It's right up there, isn't it?
Yeah.
I think, yeah.
It's funny for me to say this out loud, but there is a Canadian comedy called Letterkenny, and the wit and rhythm and body humor that is part of it, I'm like, this Shakespeare would be a writer on Letterkenny right now, I think.
Maybe if you'd ever been in a real fight, you might not be so keen for another.
What'd you say?
You heard me.
Almost bitter. Tarps off, boys. You looking for a Tilly, buddy? Let's have a Donnybrook!
Pump the brakes. You take your shirt off, but leave your sunglasses on.
What sort of backward pageantry is that?
You gonna fight with those shades or play PokerStars.com?
The Montague Shakespeare Festival runs now through April 7th, and it's supported by an arm of town government called Montague River Culture, as well as the Massachusetts Cultural Council, Eggtooth Productions, and a bevy of generous local businesses. You can learn more about the festival at MontagueShakespeareFestival.com. On the way, the Republicans' Greta Yoakam and NEPM's Nirvani Williams about Report for America. But up next, the word nerd on back-ass words. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
We are going to talk about an unusual semantic trajectory that words sometimes take in their development.
I am already so fascinated.
Semantic shifts in words.
It's like an earthquake for words when a semantic shift, like a seismic shift, happens with our English language. Emily Brewster, resident wordster from Merriam-Webster, our dictionary in Springfield.
I feel the earth move on.
What is this interesting semantic shift that you want to talk about today?
Well, we start by thinking about the usual semantic development that a word takes. Words often start out with a concrete meaning and they develop a metaphorical extension for that meaning. Mm-hmm. So you think of like a Hollywood stars. The word star there has a meaning that is, you know, this illustrious, highly lauded person. But of course, the original meaning of the word star is the thing in the sky, the celestial body. That is the usual trajectory. You think of a, you know, the warmth of a relationship. That meaning of the word warm came after the meaning that has to do with, you know, the physical sensation of warmth. I have been collecting, and it's a pretty small set, I've been collecting words that buck this trend for a long time because I think it's so fascinating when they do. So I thought we would just talk about this small set of words, but ever growing. And I would actually be interested if people came up with other ones. And I am always on the lookout for others.
A growing set of semantic shrink?
Well, it's not really shrink because they're still expanding semantically. They're just doing it in a way that is perverse.
Yes. Even better.
I can't wait to hear about these perverse words.
I've never thought of them in those terms, actually. And maybe I don't know. All right. So take, for example, the word sloth.
Hey, you guys!
I had assumed that the arboreal mammal, who's famously slow, got the name before people were slothful or something like that. But no, the word sloth and the deadly sin of indolence, that meaning predates the meaning referring to the poor, slow animal.
So they named the animal after one of the seven deadly sins?
Yeah.
Have they ever seen a sloth?
I know,
how
it's pretty harsh.
How could you do that?
I mean, they do move very, very slowly, and the poor things do get hit by cars because they move so slowly.
I have seen a dead sloth that we did have to double check to see if it was actually dead.
Yeah, which makes the rescue of them, and the rescues do happen, like, all the more fun to watch when you see videos of it.
Yeah.
Sorry.
What? Couldn't they have named it apathy?
Well, I think that would be much worse, don't you? Yes. Like, some of us can't help being slothful, and apparently sloths are among them, but apathy is...
Check out that cute apathy in the tree just hanging there.
It's all an apathy tree.
All those little apathy babies.
Yeah.
It's also interesting to just name a creature after a quality that it exhibits.
Yeah. Yes.
Like, I don't know of any... No others come to mind. The word squirrel, for example.
Squirrel!
People squirrel things away. I mean, like that definitely came after the creature that squirrels things away, right? That is the more typical kind of semantic development that a word will have. It takes on that verb use because we know what the noun refers to and what that referent does, squirrels things away. But yeah, sloth bucks that trend. It was about 400 years between the use of the word sloth to refer to indolence and the use of the word sloth to refer to the arboreal mammal.
I wonder what they called them before that.
Yeah, I don't know. In many languages, right, or in multiple languages, they had a name. But
right.
English, it could have been that just that English speakers didn't know sloths until then, and then they gave them this name.
And didn't bother to translate the indigenous word for them.
That's right. Like, that's right.
Why should we use their word?
They just decided to insult them.
We have perfectly good language over here.
Yeah,
that
is what happened.
I'm angry on behalf of sloths.
Totally. I mean, with raccoon and also with opossum, we took the indigenous word and adapted it so that we could say it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We don't call them trash pandas.
I mean, we do.
Oh, yeah, we do.
Don't call me a raccoon!
I'm sorry. I took it too far. I meant trash panda.
Is that better?
I don't know.
I know, it's probably a Puritan who came up with the name, right?
Like, no doubt.
We're an ancestor of one.
Like somebody in a pit hat, you know, like macheting their way through through the jungle.
Look how slothful these creatures are.
It's not even moving at all. It's alive. Should totally take this back and put them in my menagerie.
Another one is the word engine.
Huh.
The concrete meaning of the word engine is very, very much at the front of my mind, right? I think of my car's engine. It's a device that transfers energy into motion, basically. That's what an engine does. But the word engine did not first refer to mechanical engines. It referred to human ingenuity, and it comes from the same root as ingenuity,
ooh,
ingenium. From Latin.
Interesting.
Cool.
Yeah, right?
So
great.
Somebody then develops this thing that transfers power, maybe with internal combustion or steam or something like that, and then they think it's such an ingenious invention that they call it essentially ingenious, an engine?
Yeah. That's yep. Yeah. It's like they take that human quality and then translate it into a concrete noun. But here's the thing. It definitely was not combustion.
Right.
Because the earliest example of that use of engine as referring to some kind of mechanical device dates to the late 1300s.
Oh, wow.
And like it has to refer to like maybe like mills or something because it works kind of the same way like that.
Right. I mean, there are earlier engines that are very different from the ones that we think of.
They're probably torture devices. Like Iron Maidens.
Put them in the Iron Maiden.
Iron Maiden? Excellent!
Ingenious.
Something like that, yeah.
At what they do, for sure.
One of the now abandoned meanings of the word engine is evil contrivance.
Well.
Is that really? I mean, I feel like...
You don't think it's entirely abandoned?
No, but that might just be because I read a lot of genre fiction. But again, like that's a niche market.
So. It's absolutely legitimate, though, right? So I need to read more. So not dead use of the word engine, but not one that comes immediately to the tip of my tongue.
Yes.
What are some other examples of this strange semantic ordering of these words that may be common to us, like sloth or engine, but they are kind of beginning at the end, for lack of a better way to describe it?
The word dilate, like your pupils dilate, your pupils expand.
Yeah.
I had assumed that meaning of dilate, that medical use of the word dilate was the original one, mm-hmm. but it is not. The word has a much less common word that has to do with examining in like conversation, right? You dilate upon a subject, and that is the earliest use of dilate.
Huh.
Like when you have a broad conversation about something? Is that what it means in that context?
So when the word dilate was first used in the 14th century, it meant to comment at length, to discourse about something. And then, I don't know, why did they apply this to this very concrete expansion? Who knows? Lack of creativity, perhaps. Or just that impulse to use a word in multiple ways.
So do dilate and dialect have anything to do with each other?
I don't think those two are related, but I do think that dilate comes from a Latin word like dilatare, and that is related to dilatory, which means delaying.
So it's like filibustering.
Exactly.
You're going to expand on this conversation ad nauseum.
Yes.
Right, 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 right.
And watch your eyes glaze over as they dilate.
I do so like green eggs and ham. Thank you, Sam I am.
I have accused my children of bedtime dilatory tactics.
Nice.
Revenge bedtime.
I remember telling my daughter when she was maybe three, like, you are really a masterful dilatory tactician. And she said, I'm not dilatory tactician.
That's so cute.
I really wish I'd had a recorder.
Oh, yeah.
A gift certificate.
A gift certificate?
Yeah. Gift certificate.
How about the word gravity?
Ah.
This one is
invented by scientists.
Not invented.
It's not real.
It's not. Stop it.
Actually, don't need it.
What do you mean that we don't need gravity?
What if it was never invented?
Invented by who?
Sir Isaac Newton.
Well, all the words are invented, but the gravity itself, I'm not going to comment on whether gravity is real. I mean, I Gravity is real.
Gravity is real.
Gravity is real. That's why we're not
floating. According to the internet that I look at.
Oh, no.
Whoever created gravity, someone did, but we don't actually need it.
There was, like, there was a time on Earth before gravity existed.
Yes.
So, of course, the word gravity, we most often know it to refer to, here's the definition, the natural force that tends to cause physical things to move towards each other, the force that causes things to fall toward the Earth. But originally, gravity, if you think of other words that are related to gravity like gravitas or grave, it has to do with heaviness and seriousness.
So when they were looking for a way to describe this thing that they're learning more about through scientific means, they give it a name that has to do with grounding and coming to the Earth of some sort, a grave.
Yeah. And so it means that gravity of the situation is a more true to the original meaning of the word.
That's right.
Use of the word.
That's right. We think of that as being, it's an abstract term. So we think of it as being a metaphor for a literal use. But in fact, the abstract meaning came first.
Neat.
Yeah.
All right, first, the Fig Newton or Sir Isaac Newton?
Are we talking about just the figs or Sir Isaac Newton?
I think the Newton.
The Newton, just
it's
the
not
Newton
a cookie,
part.
Mother.
It's a fruit Newton. Carry on then, carry on.
All right, my favorite of this category is, this is the first one that I came across. It is the word parasite.
Oh.
I always assumed that really terrible moocher, right, the organism that lives on and to the detriment of its host, lives on and off of its host's body, was the earlier meaning that scientists are like, oh, we will put these two roots together and we will get a word for this creature that does this.
The people one is the first
The social parasite is the original parasite. It is Greek, but the original parasite was actually a stock character in Greek and Roman comedy.
Wow.
Yeah. Isn't that wild? The parasite was a character who would endear himself. He was pretty much always a guy. Endear himself to someone who was very wealthy so that he could enjoy the fruits of that person's table. So it was specifically about getting food.
It does seem like a common trope in even contemporary comedies, etc. You know, you got like Kramer at Seinfeld's door every day.
Yeah, totally.
You can't eat a sandwich without Dijon.
Yeah, you're right. I really should keep more of your favorites on hand.
I'm getting a vibe here.
English has words from long ago that there were also this. The word smell feast was someone who, you both flinched.
What?
I love it.
Smell feast.
Smell feast. What? The beauty of such of words with such largesse like that, where it's so specific and you know exactly what it means and it's just so evocative. I miss us using words like that.
All right, Khalees, you are in a position to change this. You need to start using smell feast more often. And if all of our listeners could also, then this word could have a resurgence. And that would be great. I would love to see it in the word of the year. Runners up. It's not going to be the word of the year. But, a smell feast is someone who can smell out a feast, right? Someone who is on the hunt for good food.
I thought you were talking about like the Smith College Bulb Show, where you just walk into a place and get bombarded with smells. That would be a smell feast. But no, if you're the person who's a parasite, you can smell it out and you can find that table.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, though, the word could develop the meaning that you're referring to also.
Right.
But as far as I know, it does not have a history of that kind of use. But so the other big question that maybe we can leave the listeners with is, what should we call this collection of words? I don't have a term for them yet.
You should write a book about these. You should compile all of them, write a book about it, and coin a term to call what these words are.
How about if so I just... Can I skip
sloth?
The book?
No. Sloth, engine, parasite.
Mm-hmm. Gravity.
Gravity.
There are a few others.
And there's no way to classify these words, name for these words.
Or for the path that they take, where they started out more general, like more abstract.
Yeah.
And then became
abstract
more
to concrete.
Yeah.
Yeah. My colleague, Ammon Shea, who you've had on the show before, he was asking me this question once also, like, what do you call them? And he suggested both the cart before the horse words, which I like. And then he also said maybe back-ass words.
Back-ass words.
Yes, you could just do back-ass words.
I like that.
Yeah.
What about, since they're sort of metaphorical, but they came before a meta three instead of a metaphor?
That one hurts a little, Monty. But if anyone has any ideas, you know, it's a, I do think that this is a category of word that, that could really use a name, and I don't have a name yet.
And then that'll be the name of your book, and then you'll get thanked in Emily Brewster's book when this book about meta-threes comes out, or back-ass words.
Meta-threes.
And if you have any questions at all about the English language for our resident wordster, Emily Brewster, from Merriam-Webster, the dictionary in Springfield, and or a name for this type of words, send it to us at thefab413@nepm.org.
I am kind of curious what the Malay word for sloth actually translates to now.
Yeah.
I'll try to find out.
Up next, the Republicans' Greta Yoakam and NEPM's very own Nirvani Williams talking about an organization aiming to rescue local journalism, Report for America. You're listening to The Fabulous 413 on 88.5 NEPM.
The Fabulous 413 podcast is funded by Northeast Solar, offering solar options, energy security, and solutions for the local community. Learn more at northeast-solar.com.
Welcome back to The Fabulous 413. I'm Monty Belmonte. Khalees Smith is away, despite Memorex Khalees Smith from that last segment. If you're someone who's long subscribed to, say, newspapers, the sheer girth of the newspaper on your stoop may feel painfully, even dangerously, thinner than it did 10, 20, or 30 years ago. Local journalism is in somewhat of a tough state and has been for a while. Report for America is a national service program that places journalists into local newsrooms to report on undercovered issues and communities, an initiative of the nonprofit media organization The Ground Truth Project. It's structured to harness the skills and idealism of an emerging group of journalists, plus the creative spirit of local news organizations, not just newspapers, but even radio newsrooms like our very own NEPM. Joining us are two journalists, who have both worked with Report for America, one currently working with Report for America, NEPM's own Nirvani Williams, and from the Springfield Republican, and until recently from the Berkshire Eagle, but also from the Daily Hampshire Gazette, the investigations editor, Greta Yoakam. Thank you both for joining us here.
Thanks for having us.
So Report for America, when I first came to NEPM, that was the first time I heard of it, and I was introduced to Nirvani Williams, and I was introduced to you as a Report for America journalist. So what does that mean for you? How did that relationship come about, first with Report for America and then with NEPM?
Totally. Well, Report for America is, like you were saying in the intro, a national program. And I applied to it hoping to secure a spot as a core member whose job is really to go into local, like, places that are like news deserts and try to report out on what's going on there as a person being in an underreported area. So I applied to Report for America, and then Report for America has a ton of job, you know, prospects that a core member can apply to. And one of them was to be an equity reporter at NEPM.
So where were you when you were in this application process? You're from New York, right?
Right. Queens, born and raised in Queens. Uh-huh. And I'd really never heard of, I'd never been to Western Mass before, and I didn't hear of NEPM, but I only really heard of it through Report for America. So then once I got through to the first stage of becoming a core member, them accepting me in, then they gave me a list of different job opportunities that they thought I could fit, one of them was to hear. And then I applied and met with our news director, Sam Hudzik, and then a few other people from the team here, and had an interview with them, and then I guess they liked me.
So I'm assuming, I wish Sam was here, we could ask him personally, but that NEPM at some point made a decision to be a Report for America newsroom, because it feels like, in some ways, it's like the Peace Corps, right? Where it's like you could sign up for the Peace Corps, you could sign up for AmeriCorps, or you could sign up for Report for America with this very particular bent of journalism.
Totally.
And you have a beat, too, right? Which was sort of like your specialty. What was that?
Yeah. Well, that here is socioeconomic disparities across the region of Western Mass, which seemed a little bit daunting to me at the time. As I was talking to Sam, our news director, He made it really approachable, I think, for me. And he was like, you know, this is going to be a large area for you to cover, not quite you know, Queens or New York City. But, you know, there's a lot that's going on here. And you, as a woman of color, could really explore in a very unique way, which really enticed me as well. And like you were saying, and that was a great point, NEPM did become a newsroom under Report for America. So Report for America also pays for half of my salary, which is what made me a bargain, I think.
A total bargain. Yes, we love that in public media for sure. It's interesting because I know that Report for America, like Gannett Newspapers, this big newspaper company, has chosen to no longer work with Report for America, at least according to Dusty Christensen yesterday. I haven't fact checked this like a good journalist would do, like you two would do. But it goes to show you the sort of the state of this giant conglomerate. It owns tons of newspapers, USA Today and a bunch of other things like that, and maybe not wanting to put a focus on the importance of local journalism. So you, Greta Yoakam, I mentioned, I followed your work when you were with the Daily Hampshire Gazette and with the Berkshire Eagle and have been not yet a year at the Springfield Republican. What came first for you, Report for America or your work as a journalist in local newsrooms?
Yeah, I was working at the Daily Hampshire Gazette and had been there for a couple years when I got an interview from Report for America. And I'd actually applied to the program several times in the past and not gotten it, and was really drawn to the training it did for early career reporters and the network you got from it, and just their overall kind of mission of helping to put more resources into local journalism, which we all love here. So, so I got the interview, and then that was at the Berkshire Eagle, and I was able to cover North Adams there and also work on investigative projects, and it was there for 2 years, which was really great.
Is that the length of a time of a term for Report for America, just like you would do, I guess, a tour in with the Peace Corps or AmeriCorps?
Yeah. I think the terms are at least a year and up to 3 years, depending. I left after 2 years to take a job at the Springfield Republican. But yeah,
are they a Report for America?
Good question. As of right now, I don't believe we have anyone through the program. No, I think you kind of apply almost like you would apply for a grant. A news organization applies and gets accepted, and then the organization helps you find a reporter to fill that slot.
Tell me about how being a Report for America reporter assisted you, coming from the Gazette where you weren't, then at the Eagle where you were, and now at the Republican where you're not. What did they offer you that helped you as a journalist?
The training opportunities are really amazing.
Totally.
We got to hear from like veteran journalists, hosts of All Things Considered from, you know, NPR.
Elsa Chang.
It was amazing.
Nice.
Just regular top-notch training opportunities offered to the cohort, and I think that was really valuable.
Totally.
Just extra support from kind of like a mentor, having that outside person to ask questions, especially when you're earlier on in your career, I think is super valuable. Yeah.
Speaking with the investigations editor, Greta Yoakam from the Springfield Republican, and NEPM's own Nirvani Williams, who is a Report for America reporter and has had national stories on NPR National. We sat right here in this studio and listened to them on All Things Considered, and that was really great and must feel really great to have your work acknowledged on such a national platform. But as I alluded to in the intro, you know, the state of journalism is on the ropes in some ways, and it doesn't seem like it's getting any better. It seems like this idea of a nonprofit like maybe NEPM, like Report for America, supporting journalism may be the only pathway forward. Dusty Christensen, who we mentioned before, works for the Shoestring, which is just that, a shoestring news organization that's community funded, because there are enough people that believe it's an important tenet to our democracy here. As younger folks, I feel like an old man compared to the both of you. What made you want to become a journalist in the first place? Let's start with you, Greta Yoakam.
That's a great question. Well, I was in college and started off as a chemical engineer, which is not a path I
followed. There's no money in that, so I decided to be a reporter.
Exactly.
I had no idea. That's incredible.
Yeah, well, I still studied computer science, but got really involved in the student news kind of scene in college and just had so much fun talking to people, writing stories, did like a senior thesis about environmental justice outside outside of Boston and a particular issue going on there. And I just had so much fun that I thought I would keep trying to do it and see if I could make it professionally.
Was it like, I don't want to make the chemicals that are causing all the problems. I want to report on the chemicals that are causing
exactly,
all the problems.
Exactly.
What about you, Nirvani Williams? What made you want to become a reporter?
Like I said, I grew up in a really small Caribbean community in Queens and Queens, New York, and I didn't really see my community portrayed in an accurate way in the news, and I thought that was such a disservice, to my people, and I just sort of thought, well, maybe what if I was the person reporting on these communities that are so underserved, that maybe are seen as only negatively in the news. And maybe I can try to make a difference there in some small way. So I went to, when I was in college, I was a journalism major and I wrote a ton of stories and you know, like we've been talking about, it's so difficult to just get your foot in the door in this industry. And especially as a woman of color, it's not when you don't have any connections to anyone in, you know, major or smaller news outlets, it can be so, so tough. So Report for America was really such a great thing to apply, like for me to apply to see that young, you know, journalists could have a place in a news organization reporting on really, really integral topics like equity, like, different investigative projects. It was cool to apply to Report for America and then actually get a job, you know, my first big girl reporter job. And it made me think, like, I better not blow it. I better not, you know, I really should take this opportunity and give it all it's got, you know?
What are some of the things that you're reporting on right now or stuff that you've reported on recently that you feel particularly was impactful or that you feel proud of? Greta Yoakam from The Republican?
Sure, yeah. Well, one story that I felt really proud of was looking at overdose prevention centers, or sometimes called supervised injection sites, and looking at the movement in Massachusetts around trying to legalize them or at least sanction them through the state since they're not really legal federally or questionably so. And so I was able to actually go to one of the first open sites. You know, there's been underground sites in the past, but the first sort of open above ground site in New York City, and see how it worked, what people, you know, in the site thought about it, and talk to the executive director of it. And so that was really cool to be able to see, like, what could it look like in Massachusetts?
What about you, Nirvani? What are some of the things that you've reported for NEPM on recently that you feel particularly proud of?
I really liked the story that I did on a Haitian migrant, a woman who came from Haiti, who was a professional chef and sort of had this partnership with Amy McMahon.
Of Mesa Verde in Greenfield. Yes.
Yeah, exactly. And they have this Haitian food pop-up every Sunday night. And I think I just think her story is fascinating considering all of the true chaos that's going on in Haiti right now, and the state of the country is so dire. Her story and coming to America, I think, and finding her way to Massachusetts and then sort of making a living with all of the resources that she was given here, has been awesome. So it's been cool. I've been getting into a lot more immigration reporting.
That one was featured on NPR National. And yeah. I think the Southwick students facing criminal charges with the investigation into the social media, the racist remarks there, was also picked up by NPR National too?
Yes, it was. That was, and that's been a story I've been reporting on too that's been really crazy because the DA in Springfield is the eight students who created this alleged mock online slave auction. They're facing criminal charges now that the DA just announced last week. And I've been following that story. That's been cool to report on in a series. And I would just like to say that meeting Greta through Report for America has just been an absolute pleasure because she's so talented and has had so many years of experience in this industry. So I wouldn't have met you if it weren't for this program.
Oh, so that likewise. Makes me feel lucky.
And having colleagues to work with is an important part of making a positive job environment. Yeah. Getting to, you know, iron sharpening iron to get better at your trade is wonderful. And as we've heard from the stories that you've covered, these are important stories for our local area. So it's great that an organization like Report for America, it's sort of the Peace Corps of journalism, exists, and that one of our journalists from NEPM, Nirvani Williams, is a part of that, as well as Greta Yoakum, who was a part of that and is now with the Springfield Republican. Thank you both so much for coming in today.
No, thank you so much.
Thanks, Monty.
Tomorrow on the Fabulous 413, we'll be talking about a documentary that will air tomorrow night on NEPM TV, Where I Became. It was filmed in South Africa and the U.S., and it's a documentary exploring the personal journeys of a group of Smithies from South Africa who left their homes to pursue their dreams here in the 413. We'll also have U.S. Congressman Jim McGovern, as always, and we'll talk with John Fisher from Wayfinders about housing and more. I'm Monty Belmonte. See you tomorrow on the Fabulous 413.